Thanks for downloading this edition of The Why Factor from the BBC, a programme that seeks to find out why we do the things we do. I hope you enjoy it.
Pikachu, Raichu, Geodude, Graveler, Golem, Onix, Zubat, Golbat, Clefairy, Clefable.
Hello, I'm Asma Mir. You're listening to The Why Factor on the BBC World Service. This week on the programme, why do crazes take off?
Magikarp, Gyarados, Articuno, Zapdos, Moltres, Mew, Mewtwo, Omanyte, Omastar, Kabuto, Kabutops.
Recently, you may have seen even more people than usual glued to their phone screens. And that's because they're following this summer's worldwide craze, Pokemon Go.
Bellsprout, Weeping Bell, Victreebel, Tangela, Voltorb, Electro.
In case you were wondering, but were too afraid to ask, what is Pokemon Go? Well, the technology on your phone makes cute little virtual monsters appear on your screen as if they're in the same location as you. You capture them on your phone and train them to fight. Simple.
Magneton, Shellder, Cloyster, Slowpoke, Slowbro.
People are going crazy for it. Sorry. The game even caused a stampede in New York's Central Park. And nuisance calls to the emergency services.
999.
It's calling again. Somebody stole my Pokemon.
Right, why is that a 999 call?
Because it's really bad. Like, I was about to get a Pikachu.
You do realise that you're stopping someone with a life or death emergency about a Pokemon?
Yes, in extreme cases, that's how bad it's got. Pokemon was first popular back in the 1990s. Remember? You could play it on the Nintendo Game Boy. Millions of children traded Pokemon cards in school playgrounds. Now, it's back. So why do some fully grown adults spend their spare time looking for virtual monsters? And why do we fall for crazes anyway?
This is Dr. Ben Michaelis. I'm a clinical psychologist and a visiting scholar at Columbia University. I think there's a number of reasons that Pokemon Go has become a craze. The first one is that it is brand new technology, this augmented reality. It's leveraging the existing interest in Pokemon and the enthusiasm for Pokemon. The other factors are that it's happening over the course of the summer, and so people want to be outside more.
Yep, sometimes it's just about timing.
I'd been working as a commercial illustrator for quite a few years and all my artwork was black and white.
Johanna Basford started another craze, adult colouring books. Hang on, colouring books? For adults? That'll never catch on. And initially the publishers weren't convinced either.
They were a little bit quiet on the other end of the phone and they weren't really sure, you know, like, who do you market that at? Do you go straight for adults or is it more of a teenage thing? So I drew up the first 5 drawings and I sent them over. I was like, this is what it's going to look like. It's going to be elegant and sophisticated and a challenge to colour in. And they saw those 5 drawings and they said, yeah, let's go for it. Let's see if we can make this work.
And it did. She's since sold more than 20 million books worldwide.
At one point, we were selling more colouring books in France than they were selling cookbooks. So I rather like the idea of all these chic Parisian women laying down their saucepans and picking up some pens. But other countries that really grasped it, I guess, would be Brazil and China, Korea.
What I don't understand about this is, where do people have the time to sit down and devote an hour or maybe 2 hours to colouring in? Because there's just too much to do. There's no space for this, is there?
I think it's precisely because we're so busy that we have this need for colouring. I think we are so plugged in and constantly looking at our devices. You can barely get through dinner time without somebody's phone beeping or chirping at them. And so with colouring in, it's such an unplugged analogue activity and it really engages bits of your brain, the creative sides that you don't typically use in our much more digital lives. The thing that really helped colouring was social media, because after you have worked on your beautiful colouring in piece and had that nice bit of Zen time to just unwind, what do you want to do? You want to share it with people. It's a very much show and tell activity where you've completed something beautiful and you want to show it off. No matter where they are or what time it is, somebody online is going to go, that's really pretty, well done, what colouring pencils did you use?
When a person or a group perceives an idea or a process or a product as being beneficial to one person or to a group of people, they immediately want to experience that benefit for themselves, which hooks into an ancient evolutionary fear of being left behind or abandoned by our tribes, and so more people join in.
Hi, today I'm going to show you how to make the triple single pattern bracelet. We're going to lay the first rubber band from here to here, and lay the second one from this pin to this pin.
The idea of loom band came from my daughters. So one day they came home from school. Two of them were teaching each other how to make rubber band bracelets from those small, tiny ponytail-sized rubber bands.
This is Chun, the creator of the Rainbow Loom. It's a plastic device for turning small rubber bands into jewellery, and it was a global craze in 2014. Children were spending hours turning rubber bands into bracelets. But in the beginning, it was just a dad trying to show his daughters that he was cool too.
I tried to impress them by making a thicker bracelet that was made from a prototype loom that I fabricated. And it was a success, and they were telling me that those bracelets are so cool, can you make more?
Chun invested his family's entire savings in the Rainbow Loom. He kept trying to sell it to the toy shop owners of Michigan, but it just wasn't happening.
It's not something like popcorn or, you know, a pair of shoes that people get an idea. So it was difficult. So that's why we did a lot of marketing ourselves. And at that time, we don't have money to spend. So I videoed my daughters making or creating bracelets and showed the kids around the world how to make bracelets with the loom band.
The last step is to cut the extra black rubber band here. Now you can wear it.
From this moment, a craze was born, making Chun's company worth an estimated $130 million. And it wasn't just children. David Beckham and the Duchess of Cambridge were seen wearing them too. And you can't get a bigger celebrity endorsement than that.
Many of these crazes can just start to get the emotional ball rolling by appealing to children, which is what a lot of these crazes tend to do. And then they quickly jump from emotionally invested children to their parents.
The 1967 technique is something to marvel at. And the lads and lasses of the new hula hoop age sure know a few things about ring craft. It was quite a happy hula happening. Olé!
Your spin needs to be really clean and around your body. If you're, when you spin it, your hoop is going all over the place, then you need to concentrate on that.
Now, I remember when I was at school, hula hooping was the big thing. All the girls loved it, and they were all so good at it, and I was completely rubbish. So I was really happy when the craze ended and all the girls moved on to something else, like Rubik's Cubes or, you know, something a bit easier. But the bad news is that hula hooping is back 30 years later, and I am in a gym in North London to see if I'm any better at it this time around.
I'm Anna Byrne, otherwise known as Anna the Hooligan, and I am a hula hoop teacher and performer and the director of Hula Fit. You can trace the history of the hula hoop back to, I think, 1000 BC. There are images of ancient Greeks using it, ancient Egyptians, Aborigines. They used, like, grapevine and bamboo, and they would make these hoops and either, like, roll them along the ground and then put them around their waist. And then in the 50s, the two founders of WAMO, which created the Frisbee and the Slippy Slide, they went over to Australia. They saw these kids playing with these bamboo hoops, thought it was a great idea, came back to California, manufactured the first plastic hula hoop, and just would give them out everywhere. And the craze was quite instant then. I think within the first 4 months, they sold 25 million hoops.
Why 5960? What was it that was happening in the world at that point?
At that time, it was just plastic manufacturing was bigger. I guess the 50s was also the introduction of the television. Like, every American household had a television by then. So I think advertising was being used to sell things a lot more intensely. I think it appealed to children and it appeals to women. And children were using it as a toy. These 50s housewives were using it at home to get fit.
Why do you think it keeps coming back, especially now? Because it seems like a very old-fashioned, and I mean that in a nice way, thing. So why in 2016 are people using hula hoops?
So I think it's kind of a combination of fitness and people wanting to keep fit and toned, as well as wanting to be sociable and not spending the money in the pub. But they want to kind of do something and learn something with it. The face that people give is the same the world over. Whenever I bring my hoops out, I'll get, you know, these adult ladies. They're like, oh, I haven't done this since I was a child, or I've never been able to do this. And they pick it up, and this face is just amazing, this smile. It's like, it's a childish look, you know, you had it. It's like, oh, my gosh, I can do it. Oh, my gosh, it's amazing.
So 30 years on, am I any good? Well, that's the sound of my hula hoop clattering to the ground for the 15th time. So, no. Not all crazes are harmless fun. William Stainsby was a bright and talented 12-year-old from Kent in southeast England.
It was 5 years ago in June. He had just finished year seven in his grammar school, and he'd come home. We were chatting. He had to go and do some homework upstairs. He went upstairs. I called him for supper. He didn't come down, but I thought, that's okay. He needs a bit longer on this piece of homework anyway. And when another 10 or 15 minutes had gone past, I thought, I'll go up and get him.
William's mum, Sabrina Lapel, found him hanging in the hallway.
He was blue, so I knew something was desperately wrong. I couldn't revive him through CPR, which I know how to do. I called an ambulance and they did the best they could, and then they took him off to the hospital, but he was pronounced dead.
Sabrina believes her son had been part of the so-called choking game craze, which involves cutting off oxygen to the brain. The game is believed to have been around for decades in the US. But social media has meant that it spread much more quickly and widely in recent years.
Did you manage to work out retrospectively where he had learned about this?
Not completely. I'm thinking it happened in the playground. The policeman said to us that he felt confident that in future years somebody might wander into the police station and just say, look, I feel really terrible because I taught William Stainsby the game. So it's often older children who are bringing this in to the playground. My husband and I are really convinced that had we known about the game, we would certainly have talked to William about it. And whilst he might not have admitted to us that he knew about it or was playing it, if we'd have told him that it can go wrong very easily, particularly if you play it on your own, but it can still go wrong when you play it with someone else, and that your brain is dying, he would have been horrified and he would have stopped straight away.
Sabrina says that there are signs that a child might be playing this game. A ligature on a door handle, bloodshot eyes, headaches and forgetfulness. And by telling parents to watch out for these signs, she hopes this horrible craze might fade and eventually disappear. For many, Japan is seen as the home of crazes. It's where Pokemon, Transformers, Power Rangers and Tamagotchi all come from. And it's home to some even more unusual crazes. Matthew Alt lives in Tokyo and is the co-founder of Alt Japan, a company which produces English versions of Japanese games.
One of the big crazes going on right now in Japan is for regional mascot characters. And this fad for these characters, these mascot characters, kind of exploded last year with this one mascot in particular called Funasi, who takes the form of this giant, rotund Asian pear with a big smiley face on.
Yep, you heard him right, a smiley pear.
And Funasi seemed to infiltrate itself into nearly every aspect of Japanese life for a while there. It was on talk shows. It was getting involved in movies. It was going abroad and interacting with foreign stars. nearly everybody you saw within a certain age range, certainly teenagers and young adults, had some kind of funashi trinket or memorabilia with them.
Japan has a long tradition of crazes.
And that goes back well over a century, even back to before Japan opened its ports to the West, when there was a very big market for things like kabuki plays and woodblock prints and things like that that people would buy as consumers in what we would pretty much consider a pre-consumer society. But as to why Japanese people in particular seem to have a more accepting attitude toward fads, I think, is because in Japan, it's not perceived as uncool to be doing what other people are doing.
If Japan is the home of crazes, does that mean that some people are more prone to obsess over them than others? Psychologist Ben Michaelis thinks so.
People that are more emotionally insecure are far more likely to get drawn in because more of their self-esteem is invested in appearances rather than a strong sense of self.
Although you might think it's mostly young children who start and maintain crazes, in Japan it's a different group who devote themselves to the latest thing.
When you talk about mass crazes in Japan, you can't discount the power of young women and teenage girls. They wield a disproportionate influence in getting fads started and keeping them going here in Japan. In the case of emoji in particular, Japanese women were looking for cuter ways to express themselves in text messages and in emails, ways to soften what they were saying or to add a little flair to what they were talking about. And by so doing, they actually hooked their boyfriends on them.
But overall, crazes are short-lived. And I suppose that's the point. A craze is something that arrives, sweeps us along, and then fizzles out to be replaced by the next one.
They provide us with a temporary sense of increased status and an increased joy that we have when we are doing whatever the craze is. But the reality is that we tend to adapt very quickly to any increase in status we have. It's called a hedonic adaptation. For example, let's say you've always wanted an apartment with a view, and then you get an apartment with a view. You will enjoy that view for a little while, but then it'll just kind of fade into the background because you've adapted to that newer level.
So, should you be worried if Pokemon Go still means absolutely nothing to you?
I do think that it will fade. I don't think it will be nearly as popular at Christmas as it is now. It'll still retain some of its popularity, but these things tend to have a short shelf life.
Phew, that's a no then. Thanks for listening to The Y Factor. If you'd like to hear more episodes, there's a wide range of programmes on our website. Visit bbcworldservice.com/Y Factor.